This is the biggest thing to hit the profession in a really long time. It's the biggest shakeup. It's the biggest change. So I think there is incredible opportunity here for this to impact both the in-house finance teams as well as external firms, consultancies, and the auditors.
Welcome back, gang. This is episode number 181 of Future Proof. Bill Sheridan here. How you doing, by the way? Hope things are well. Pulling those heavy coats and extra blankets out of the closet, right? Getting a little chilly out there. I guess it's that time of year. I'm just such a wimp about the cold. You know, as my dad used to say, if you're this cold in October, what are you going to do when winter comes? Right? Fair question. I'll put on a sweater, I guess. Light a fire. Whatever. Anyway, hope you're keeping warm, gearing up for what I think is the best time of the year anyway. Chilly weather, notwithstanding. But anyway, nothing makes me happier than fall moving into winter, my time of year. I'm also happy. really bad transition ahead, by the way, just fair warning. But I'm also happy that we're talking about ESG this week. Lots of questions and uncertainty surrounding this particular trend. So I'm glad that we're going to try to answer some of that stuff for you this week. First, though, let's start with this. This week's show is sponsored by the Business Learning Institute, which delivers competency-based curriculum, courses, content, and community to maximize career trajectories and grow intellectual capital for organizational and executive leadership. Hundreds of courses by dozens of instructors and unlimited customization. Find out how the Business Learning Institute can help you by visiting blionline.org. So on to ESG. That's environmental, social, and governance for the uninitiated. Investors are increasingly applying these non-financial factors as they investigate which public companies they will invest in. And regulators are increasingly requiring that companies include these types of factors in their financial statements. Now, some politically minded folks in our profession and elsewhere will tell you that this is nothing more than, you know, another quote unquote woke trend from the left that has no business in our profession. But, you know, regardless of what you think about it, it appears that ESG is here to stay and that we're going to have to deal with it. And that means that there are plenty of opportunities for accounting and finance professionals, if you know where to look. For those who work for public companies, the opportunities for establishing your ESG cred in your financials seem obvious. The SEC itself has proposed standardized regulations for how public companies report on climate-related risks and their own carbon emissions. And you'd better believe that auditors are paying attention to all of that. And so are CPA firms, by the way. The SEC's proposal very well could kickstart a new rush for ESG-related accounting services. And firms are scrambling to establish that niche right now as well. So this is a recent Journal of Accountancy article titled How Firms Are Seizing the ESG Opportunity. In that article, Andrew Kenny writes, quote, until recently, climate disclosures and other ESG issues were the domain of the biggest companies and accounting firms. But the proposed new climate regulations already are cascading from large public companies to their suppliers and contractors throughout the United States and global economies, creating significant opportunities for new business for accounting firms in the ESG space. To meet the demand, though, firms will need to develop talent and expertise in an emerging field. Research from the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants and the International Federation of Accountants underlines the opportunity for firms to provide assurance engagements for ESG information. The 2021 State of Play report found that U.S. companies seek assurance on ESG information at higher rates than the global average, but that relatively few have been seeking assurance from CPAs so far. Officials with the AICPA expect that to change as companies are driven toward more standardized reporting, end quote. And, you know, when you factor in all the folks who are attached to this issue outside of our profession, building owners, for example, who must report emissions data on their facilities up the chain, sometimes on a floor by floor basis. You know, stuff like that, you start to realize that ESG impacts almost everybody, right? This isn't just a public company issue. This impacts private companies, their CPAs and auditors, investors, regulators. I mean, almost everybody. So I'm really happy to welcome as my guest this week, Alyssa Raid. Alyssa is Chief Sustainability Officer at Sustain Life, which offers solutions that are uniquely designed to make taking climate action easier and more affordable for companies of all kinds. I heard Alyssa speak at a conference recently, and she kind of blew my mind by explaining how wide-ranging the implications of ESG really are. So we sat down recently and talked about what ESG is and what it isn't, what all this means for CPAs in public practice and business and industry, for public companies and private, for investors, for auditors. There's just so much to consider here. So I'm really glad that you're here this week. Really interesting and important stuff. Here is my conversation with Alyssa Raid. Alyssa, thanks for being here today. So, I think we're at the point now where most people probably have an idea of what ESG is. They've certainly heard enough about it, but I think there's still a lot of confusion around it. So I'm curious, how would you define it? What does it mean to you?
I'm so happy that you asked this question, actually, because I think there is a lot of confusion around what ESG really means. You hear it everywhere. You can't turn on the financial news without hearing ESG. And there's so many new folks, you know, kind of new to it that are engaged with it. And I think it's really important to kind of remember where ESG actually came from. So obviously ESG stands for E, environmental, S, social, and G, governance. But what's really important to note is that ESG as a term is not about the intrinsic value of those things or about being a good corporate citizen overall. What ESG is about the risk that a company is exposed to across those ESG criteria. And there was this great Green Biz article that came out several months ago. I will send you the link that I always bring up when I have this conversation with folks. Mm-hmm. And there's a quote in it that I just think is so powerful in honing this, really honing this in. And it says, ESG has nothing to do with making the world a better place. What ESG has to do within the capital markets is ensuring that you, as an allocator of capital, understand the risks associated with environmental, social, and governance issues from the perspective of how do you make the most amount of money in your investments.
Well, that makes sense when you think about it from, you know, the standpoint that most people talk about it, which is reporting this stuff so that investors can, you know, understand what the businesses that they're investing in are dealing with in regards to this stuff. So that's a really interesting point. I hadn't really thought of it in that way before. Here's another thing that I've heard a lot recently is this notion, and this I'm speaking specifically about the accounting and finance profession now. More and more people I'm hearing are saying that this is a big opportunity for this profession in particular. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, because this is kind of a diverse profession too, right? I mean, we're talking about folks who work on the industry side, folks who work on in public practice. I mean, across the board. So, tell me a little bit about your thoughts about this as an opportunity for accountants and finance professionals.
Yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity for the profession. And I say this with all due respect, but I think it's the profession's opportunity to lose. I really do. I think with these public disclosure requirements that are now tying climate disclosure to financial filings, who is better suited to take over this process than the folks that are already organizing the company's financial data for public disclosure? So now that climate disclosure is supposed to follow the same process and format and organizational boundaries that are established in the 10K, it's only sensible that the profession would take ownership of what's now becoming a critical new business function, especially for companies without in-house sustainability teams. And there are many.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about on the audit side? When you talk about audit opportunities in terms of that.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have this kind of phase in period of when companies will need to get their data audited and get, you know, limited and reasonable assurance for their various scope 1-2 emissions. And so there's a huge opportunity for the auditors to obviously pick this up in their practice as a new service offering for all of their corporate clients. This is work that needs to be done. And there's actually no one else who can do it but the auditor, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we're at this really critical juncture. And speaking to auditors in the profession, you know, I'm hearing that this is the biggest thing to hit the profession in a really long time. It's the biggest shakeup. It's the biggest change. So I think there is incredible opportunity here for this to impact both the in-house finance teams as well as external firms, consultancies, and the auditors.
And you said a moment ago that this is our opportunity to lose. Like, who might we lose it to if we don't move? Like, who's waiting in the wings to kind of take advantage of this stuff?
Well, that's interesting. I think on the audit side, no one, right? Like, to date, you have these boutique firms, often engineering firms or small consulting firms that are doing the data verification. But now if this information needs to actually be audited and be included in the financial filing, I really do think, you know, you need your auditor to be doing that. But when it comes to actually compiling the information, like I said, one is there are these boutique firms that are historically, that's who's been doing this work to date. You can work with a small engineering firm, boutique consulting firm, and they've been helping a lot of corporate clients. And then there's also other in-house teams. You know, in my experience, if you're at a company that has a pretty robust or mature sustainability team that's well integrated into the operations of your business, you know, it's obviously not as competitive. You're all working for the same company, and they can honestly be your biggest resource, you know, to support in this work. Because another key distinction when we think about the profession kind of taking over ESG disclosure is, where are they going to be getting all this information from, right? All of a sudden they are reporting on things, but that data is coming from other places. And, you know, some of it might be coming from operations, some of it might be coming from sustainability, from procurement, from purchasing, you know, from HR when we talk about social criteria. And so I think those are all different departments that could also step up to do this work. But really the way it's going to be the most successful and the most rigorous with the most integrity is if the finance, you know, and accounting teams are involved in this.
I'm curious, have you encountered many folks or businesses who are offering a little bit of pushback on this whole ESG notion in terms of, I don't know, the politics that's rightly or wrongly seem to be connected to a lot of this stuff, right? And you get people who say, this is not a big deal. This is not something we need to pay attention to. I mean, are you seeing any of that? And how is that all that playing out in this area?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if we go back to Engage, you know, a week or two ago, how the time flies, you know, I spoke on a panel about the value of ESG reporting. And we opened that panel by asking folks to raise their hands of who had even heard of ESG. And we got, you know, a couple of hand raises, but especially from the smaller firms. If you're in the top four, the top 10, I mean, probably top 50, you know about ESG. You have been providing these services for clients for years already. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, historically, the real drive for ESG comes from three places. It comes first and foremost from a supplier network effect, right? So you have these big companies, these big corporates, Walmart, for example, that have ambitious goals around climate action. And there's things that they can do within their operation and their organization. But a lot of the things are outside of their organizational boundary. And so they push it down to their supply chain so that if you want to do business with Walmart, you better be telling them, you know, these are our emissions. This is your allocation of the emissions. Here's what we're doing across our ESG programs. Here's where we play. This is what we're paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And so that's traditionally been the biggest driver. The second driver we now also see is investor pressure. So a similar type thing, but investors, going back to that idea of risk, need a way to evaluate the risk of their potential investments or their portfolio companies against these criteria. So they're asking them to report, not always, you know, per se disclosed in the 10K, but, you know, in some kind of an ESG report or to bench, you know, there's industry specific benchmarks or to CDP, things like that. Right. And then the new driver that we see is this regulation is now across the US, this new SEC proposed rule that would require all public companies to disclose their emissions. And so I'm sorry, I think I actually forgot what your initial question was.
No, that's okay. Because this ties into a couple of other questions that I want to ask. My initial question was like pushback from anybody who might, you know, rightly or wrongly tie this stuff to political pressures or things of that nature when it comes to things like environment or social type of things. I don't know if you've seen any of that or.
I honestly think that if and when that pushback exists, it is from, frankly, an uninformed audience who doesn't understand at the core what ESG is. Because mm-hmm. like I just said, it's not about some political agenda and being this leading corporate citizen and excelling across, you know, all of your environmental programs. Right. It is about understanding and conveying the risk that your business has to the capital markets and investors. And so there's really not pushback there because, you know, and I actually wanted to talk a little bit about the risk, if I can, that like ESG is this investor driven ecosystem, call it. You know, several years ago, you had TCFD come into play, which is the Task Force on Climate-Related Disclosure, chaired by Michael Bloomberg. And this was all about financial markets needing clear, comprehensive, and high-quality information on the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. And why? There were three main reasons, and this is as outlined by TCFD. One, risk assessment, right? Which allows businesses and the markets that they're part of to more effectively evaluate climate-related risks to your company, your suppliers, your competitors, the industry, et cetera. So for like, what does that look like in practice, right? As an example, if you're a wheat grower and you're in a region that's susceptible to the 100-year floodplain or storm surges or some kind of extreme weather event, whatever the natural disaster is, understanding that risk allows you, the wheat grower, to make informed decisions about how or what or where you decide to grow your crop. Maybe you make decisions about moving, you know, investing money in operations that are more inland or are in different regions that, you know, aren't prone to as frequent or extreme weather events. Mm-hmm. If you're the buyer of wheat, let's say like that grower is in your supply chain, understanding the risks of which of your suppliers might be exposed or vulnerable to these kinds of events allows you to future-proof your business and make informed decisions about who you decide to partner with and, you know, rest your supply chain on. So that was the first one about risk assessment.
Yeah.
The second reason was about back to that capital allocation. So it's a similar idea about decision-making with your suppliers, but it's giving the capital market insight to the risks of their investments. So in that example above, you want to invest, you know, in wheat commodities. Are you going to invest in the company that's in the floodplain or in the one that has, you know, lesser exposure to those extreme weather events?
Gotcha.
And then the third one is strategic planning, right? Whether you're on the business side, you know, it's just better, the ability to better evaluate the risks and exposures over a short, medium, and long term. So that as you make decisions, thinking about the short, medium, and long term, you're able to make them, you know, informed and with insight, and then also convey them to your stakeholders and explain why maybe you're doing something that might have a short term impact, you know, negative impact, but is much safer and less prone to risk on a longer or medium term impact. Yeah.
Boy, those are great examples. And thank you for those. That clarifies a lot. I want to go back to something you mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, the SEC's proposed rules on disclosure. So I guess a couple of questions there. Where does that stand and how might that rule impact companies at this point?
Yes. So that rule was proposed in March. It is going through a public comment period that I believe was supposed to end in May. And I think they extended to the end of June. I believe it's the end of this month that the public comments are due. So read the several hundred page law, get your comments in. But there's a couple different components of this law. There's a piece around conveying your climate related risks and opportunities, everything that we've just spoken about. And the second piece is about disclosing your greenhouse gas emissions across various scopes. And there's different, you know, kind of footholds for if you're a small business or, you know, whether you've done certain things. But the way that this impacts companies is that any public company now in the US will have to disclose their scope 1 and 2 emissions, which are essentially energy related emissions. Scope 1, and I have this like short term for how I remember them, but it's the 3 B's of burn, buy, and beyond. And so scope 1 is any fuel that your organization is actually burning. So this is like gas in company cars and propane, diesel fuel in equipment or machinery, as well as chemical fugitive emissions. And then the buy is energy related emissions from electricity that you buy, or steam, heat, cooling, any energy. And so every company will have to disclose those. Now, the current rule also includes this requirement to disclose, in some cases, your scope 3 value chain emissions. And what that is emissions that occur outside your organizational boundary and through your supply chain. So that's the example of any supplier that you, major supplier that you do business with. It's what percent really of their emissions are you responsible for, because they're doing all that work and creating all that product or performing that service for you. And so what that means is that even private companies that are not directly mandated by the law are now going to be asked by their large public customers to measure and report their greenhouse gases to those customers, because it makes up part of that scope 3 emission.
Uh-huh. And that's that actually answers my next question. I was going to ask you, like, what do private companies have to be paying attention to here? It's right there, right? If they're doing business with any type of other company that has to comply with this stuff, then it gets really complicated.
So. Exactly. And so it takes, you know, traditionally emissions disclosure has been voluntary. And I think it's something like 30% of companies voluntarily disclose their emissions. And it happens in an inconsistent way, right? Because it's not regulated. So sometimes you have companies almost cherry pick what they want to include in their emissions inventory in terms of what they're measuring or what locations or portions or divisions of their business they're including. And so what the law does and seeks to do is really standardize that process so that you are compelling these businesses to measure and report and convey the whole picture and not necessarily just the most flattering picture, so that the market, investors, you know, stakeholders across the value chain can make those informed decisions about the business.
All right. So we talked a little bit about opportunities. What are some of the biggest challenges you've seen businesses kind of run into as they're making their way through this stuff?
I think there are two big challenges. The first one is more of a philosophical challenge, and that is that so much of making progress in climate action and ESG is actually just understanding the ecosystem that you're operating in, understanding the terms and the topics and this whole alphabet soup of standards and frameworks and greenhouse gas emissions and CO2e. I mean, even ESG itself is in the alphabet soup. Mm-hmm. And so understanding how these things connect to one another, where they intersect and exist in relation to one another, is half the battle. Just getting stable footing and feeling comfortable understanding the ecosystem that you're navigating and operating in. The second thing is a bit more tactical. And I think the biggest challenge is actually getting access to high quality, verifiable or reliable data. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies, they're not used to measuring this stuff. They don't even know who to ask at their company for it. And an easy example I'll give is like electricity. So electricity, you'd think pretty easy. I pay the bill. You know, there's going to be a kilowatt hour number there that I should be able to report. There's math. There's tools that exist that can do the math to translate that to a carbon output. A lot of companies, if you think about it, if you have offices across the country and you are located in multi-tenanted buildings and you're just an office or a floor or several floors in that building, you may not hold the utility account. Your landlord does, the building owner does. And so if you're not submetered, meaning measured specifically for the energy you consume in that portion of the building, let's say your landlord, your manager pays the bill for the whole building and they can't actually allocate, they have no separate measurement to tell what energy is being consumed specific to your floors versus all the other floors and all the other tenants, so that you can have super efficient LED lighting and VFDs and, you know, all these mechanical upgrades to your equipment. But if there's no way to actually measure the kilowatts that you're consuming in your space, you don't have access to that information to even put that data in to generate those emissions. And so some regions like New York City, there's actually laws that require that, you know, every space over 5,000 feet is submetered so that you have access to this data as a tenant. but that's New York City. That's the real estate capital of the world, right? Right. Well, I say that as a New Yorker. So, but you know, what about other places in the country where that's not the norm? These submeters, they cost money, right? Like there's, it just, it introduces the concept of this real transition in what we'll have to do to actually get this reliable data moving forward at scale and in, you know, perpetuity.
It's really interesting. It's almost like the SEC is, as unusual as it sounds, might be moving faster than a lot of the other folks that are tied to this initiative. I mean, is it possible that we might see that type of measurement start to be regulated on a bigger scale than just citywide or statewide? Is it, I don't know.
That's a really tricky one, honestly. Yeah. You know, each state has their own kind of energy services department. They have their own public utilities. You know, it's a really different and nuanced market. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if you can have sweeping federal legislation that regulates that at scale, but I do think what it will do is motivate the more regional and local cities and states to realize, okay, this is coming down the pike. You know, how can we create an environment that allows our businesses, that allows our stakeholders to be successful here, yeah, right? And it's kind of, you know, usually you don't think of regulation as a business as like a good thing or something you're looking forward to, right? It's kind of raining on my parade. Right. But this could be an example of actually having some forcing mechanisms, you know, from regulation that help you actually comply and push the market to be more readily able to comply with these, you know, larger federal mandates. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. All right. So tell me a little bit about what Sustain.life and other organizations like yours, what are you doing and how does this all come to play in this area?
Sure. So Sustain Life is a SaaS platform and we help businesses launch sustainability programs and build towards ambitious goals like net zero. So this is companies that maybe you have, you're compelled by the climate disclosure law. Maybe you just want to start getting engaged here. You're not actually compelled by the law, but you want to launch a program, help strategize. What does sustainability mean for my business? Where can we take action here? Where are we going to have the most material impact? What's most important for us? And really, doing what I talked about is kind of that more philosophical challenge that businesses are facing, but just contextualize what the landscape of climate action and ESG means and opportunities for you as a business to engage. We have this whole ethos around lowering the barrier to access and engage in sustainability. Because it used to be maybe more of a niche or siloed effort or discipline within an organization. And what we're seeing through, you know, federal disclosure laws, like this proposed SEC rule, is it really needs to be woven into the fabric of how every company operates. The same way that every company has an accounting team that's responsible, you know, for the numbers and the figures and the finances. It's really transitioning businesses to be able to upskill their own workforce and integrate sustainability and climate action into the very foundation of how they operate as a business.
That's great. I imagine business is pretty good right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really exciting time to be in this space. Traditionally, this has really been owned by consultants, right, doing this work for companies and helping them strategize and grow and lead them, you know, to progress and grow their programs. And we actually work quite closely with consultants, actually giving them our platform and tools to help, you know, scale and leverage their work and services to clients. But there aren't even enough sustainability professionals to meet the demand of work that the market is demanding. There is a statistic out there, and I always forget where it comes from, but it's something to the effect of like demand for sustainability professionals is growing at 8% a year, and the workforce talent pool is growing by only 6% a year. Mm-hmm. So there's this real delta in terms of businesses needing and wanting to do this work, and literally they're not being enough informed, skilled professionals to service them. And so that's why I think we're seeing right now this huge digital transformation affect the sustainability space, because these professionals need the tools to be able to scale their own offering, because, you know, there's just not enough of them to be doing it in a more traditional consultant-led model.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. All right. So for folks listening who are just kind of getting started in this area, where can they go for more information, more resources, things that can kind of help them along the path? Where would you suggest they turn?
I would actually say that the AICPA has some really incredible resources specific to greenhouse gas accounting and inventory emissions and disclosure available on their website. I forget what the exact URL is, but they've done a lot of work here to help guide the profession to understand, you know, this is coming. And they've been doing this for many, many years. And I think it's now just getting kind of the visibility because there's that demand. There's folks asking, where do I get started? I need some help. Right, so right. They have some really great resources. I, of course, would be remiss if I didn't plug Sustain Life. We've got an active blog, you know, tons of kind of thought leadership to help guide companies through this process. I frankly do a lot of webinars on just introducing carbon accounting and what it all means. Like, we all pay so much attention to disclosure and reporting these figures, but what do they actually represent? What do they tie back to in your business? And really kind of closing that gap between reporting and disclosure and operational programs. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Fantastic. I've got the URL for that AICPA page. So we'll share that with folks in the show notes. And in the meantime, Alyssa, this has been a great overview, a lot to chew on here. And I just really appreciate your time and your insights. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. So all that said, is there anything I did not ask that I should have or something you want to mention that we didn't or...
Let me think. This is where I'm supposed to be prepared to have some like really valuable lasting.
Yeah. I always tell people no is a perfectly acceptable answer, but I just always want to make sure that I didn't forget anything important. So,
you know, honestly, the last piece of information that I would advise of your listeners is honestly just start doing some education and ask questions. Like, this is a space that is evolving in real time. There's a decent history, a couple decades of companies pursuing voluntary sustainability programs, which morphed into ESG once the investor community became involved. So there is a history there, but it has expanded at such speed and encompassed, you know, so many new actors and kind of stakeholders. So just start learning and ask questions, because I think you'll be surprised. You know, there's tons of informed experts in the space, but it's that insight and those questions and frankly connecting, well, I'm the auditor and this is the way we do things, or I'm this department and this is the way we do things. And now we're being asked to do this other thing. You know, a little bit of it is figuring it out. And so having thoughtful insight as you kind of connect those dots is truly valuable here.
Yeah, that's great. All right, we'll make sure we include that as well. Couple final questions. Could you send me a current bio and a photo that you like to use? Just to kind of, we can use those to kind of help promote the podcast when it comes out. Sure. That would be helpful. Second question. I think I mentioned this at Engage as well. I mean, we're all about trying to find folks who are offering resources and solutions that are, you know, that our members can use to help them along this path as well. And I'm wondering, is there anybody there at Sustain Life that we might want to reach out to start those conversations about how we can get you guys in front of our members and position your thought leadership in ways that can help them as well? I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can send an email, but our head of strategic partnerships is the right person to kind of link up. You know, we do a lot of partnerships and we are actually like quite active with the accounting profession. I actually don't know if you know, but we're participants in the AICPA, CPA.com accelerator. And so like we're actually working with advisors from the profession to help guide the features and functionality of our tool to meet the needs of the profession as they're being asked and tasked to set to kind of step up here. So it's a hugely valuable partnership kind of segment for us. So I'll link you up with him, and he is the right man to kind of drive and figure out like what kind of, you know, relationship, offering, partnership, whatever, like the best way to engage.
That's fantastic. That's actually kind of serendipitous. We're CPA.com is a great partner of ours for a number of years now. And so there might be some ways that we can work with you through them too. So if you can do an e-invite or You know what I'm talking about, but just introduce me to him and we can start that conversation going.
Yeah, yeah, I can send an email. I'll send an intro email. And then if you want to book time, if you like using your Calendly or whatever your booking link is, like we can just get some time down.
Perfect. That's all I got. Alyssa, thank you so much. This has been fun and informative, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Totally. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad that I could participate, and it's a really unique audience to talk to about this stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like they are really expected and needed to step up, and they don't have deep, you know, climate or sustainability expertise. And so it's honestly one of the more fun parts about my job is like getting to bridge that gap, you know, and really empower the profession to like take an active ownership role here.
Yeah. That's great. We need more people like you. So, thanks for that. And thanks for this, and have a great weekend. Appreciate it.
All right. Great. You too.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Really great talk there about an important topic with Alyssa Rade, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Sustain Life. If you want to learn more, visit sustain.life. sustain.life, or check out our blog at macpa.org for this week's show notes. Lots of related resources there. And don't forget, this week's sponsor, again, is the Business Learning Institute. BLI's Future Ready Learning Framework outlines the skills that CPAs need to thrive in the rapidly changing world of accounting and finance. That framework is all about gaining and maintaining deep technical knowledge along with a strategic skill set. And here we're talking about strategic aptitudes that have been identified as most crucial for tomorrow's CPA. Start mastering these future-ready skills now by visiting macpa.org/future-learning-framework. And that's all I got, gang. Have a great week. Talk to you again soon.